Well, even though Mark is not here, I will welcome you to session 173 of the 2010 Sunstone Symposium, some sad stories. Sad being an acronym for stay-at-home dads. Let's see. I would like to remind you to speak into the mic. Apparently it helps people hear. I'm supposed to tell this to these people. Remember that we're recording this for future generations. This will eventually become genealogy. And so at the end of the session, when we're finished speaking, if you want to ask questions or comments, come up to that mic there. That's our testimony mic there. We don't have any deacons, though. They're on strike. So you have to come up by yourself. Remember that there are book sales, and if you buy books, it helps Sunstone, and everyone wants to help Sunstone. So, we are a bunch of stay-at-home dads, and we're going to tell you about our experiences, being such a rare breed. It all started last year when there was a stay-at-home mom panel, and it was a lot of fun. And when it got over, Mark England stood up and said, "Hey, we should have a stay-at-home dad panel." So that's what we're doing. We got together all the stay-at-home dads that we could find. This is the sum total of the stay-at-home dads in the Mormon religion. Oh, here he comes. I had just credited you with the idea of doing this, Mark, just to let you know. Look, there is a panel. You're okay? All right. So I'm going to introduce the people here for you. I'm Stephen Carter. I'm the editor of Sunstone, and I'm a stay-at-home dad of three children, and you'll hear a lot more about that later. Mark England, who just came in, he's an artist and a gelato maker who was a stay-at-home dad of four children. So Mark outranks me. This is John Gustav Rethel, who is an adjunct professor of American religious history, and he's also a paralegal at a patent law firm in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He and his spouse, Goran, is that how you say it? I'm sorry.
Urine.
Have been foster parents since December 2007. And in order to meet the demands of parenthood, John actually persuaded his law firm to let him work from home. You'd make a good lawyer.
Yeah. It took some persuading.
And this is Joseph West. He has an MA in sociology from the University of Arizona, and he's currently working on his PhD at Arizona. He was a stay-at-home dad for 2.5 years before entering graduate school in 2008. And this is Ken Gerber, who's my brother-in-law, meaning he married the sister of the girl who married my brother. We're close. He was the one who greeted his children when they got home pretty much their entire lives. He has been the primary caregiver and house husband of... Hold on to your chairs. 6 foster children and 2 sons. This guy outranks everybody. So we're going to go with me, and then we're going to go in the order that I talked about him in.
Oh, can I go last, please?
Mark will go last.
Thank you.
So we'll just go in the reverse order. Right? Okay, we're going to go in reverse order. Oh, also remember that there's the Giving Tree back by the registration booth, and that is where you help us get through the rest of the year. You'll notice that you can buy little ornaments that will allow us to do things like keep the lights on and pay for a magazine issue and things like that. So if you'd go back and buy one of those ornaments after this, God will bless you. So, I am Stephen Carter, and I'm going to start this by saying hi. I'm Stephen Carter. I'm a stay-at-home dad. And you're all going to say,
"Hi, Stephen."
I never thought that I would be in this position. My father set a good example for me because he worked outside the home to support his family of 9 children. He outranks all of us. And my mother dutifully and probably even happily stayed at home to raise us. But now, look at me. Home all day while my wife goes to her job. Who's changing the baby's diaper? Me. Who has all the episodes of Bear in the Big Blue House memorized? Me. Who dances the funky chicken with her? Me. Her father, the one who should be away. Every day, the ghost of Spencer W. Kimball stops by the house and gives me a stern look. Only in an emergency, he intones. Then Ezra Taft Benson stops by and calls through the window, Adam, not Eve, was instructed to earn the bread by the sweat of his brow. So how did I come so far down the path of unrighteousness? It started like this. I got a degree in English. It seemed a small enough sin. But I'm here to tell you, brothers and sisters, computer science, business, and accounting are the only paths to righteousness. All else is vanity. Pursue the love of language at your own spiritual hazard, for you will soon find yourself quoting the bard as you stock shelves at a chain store to support your new baby. So in order to keep finances above water, my wife went to work. But I want to quickly note that she was working inside the home. She had a technical writing job, so we were still technically righteous. It seemed very important at the time. But for 1 year, I was righteous. For 1 year, I supported my family by the sweat of my brow by holding down 3 jobs. I never saw my children or my wife. Just the mortgage and credit card bills. So then I was a real man, and I was also a prime candidate for a Mount St. Helens-sized ulcer. But that ulcer would spew righteousness. Sorry, that's kind of a gross image. Strangely, even though I was at home so little, I was still feeling some dissonance over my role as a father. Because there are still plenty of prophets who have told us that fathers need to spend time with their families. For example, in 2008, President Ukdorf said, "Do you think God will care how packed our schedule was or how many important meetings we attended? Do you suppose that our success in filling our days with appointments will serve as an excuse for failure to spend time with our wife and family?" But interestingly, only a few paragraphs later, he follows up with an example of a righteous husband, John Rowe Moyle, who worked for years on the Salt Lake Temple as a stonecutter. This is how a righteous father may act. Every Monday, John left home at 2 o'clock in the morning and walked 6 hours in order to be at his post on time. On Friday, he would leave his work at 5 o'clock in the evening and walk almost until midnight before arriving home. He did this year after year. So apparently, one of the definitions of a righteous husband could be someone who is recovering from a marathon walk every weekend. So it finally became evident that I would not be able to support my family with my current education level or my job prospects. So I decided to go to graduate school because I've heard that if you go to graduate school, you get more money. So I signed myself up for a master's program in creative writing. Yes, my brothers and sisters, weep for me. Mourn my blindness. Say a prayer for me because it gets worse. My wife also signed up for graduate school. Some infernal power must have been at work because somehow we both got into the same program. We both got teaching assistantships to support ourselves with. And not only that, we managed to work out our schedules around each other so that one of us could always be at home to take care of the kids. While the other was off learning the elements of plot or character or language or postmodern queer theory interpretations of Pilgrim's Progress. I admit it, my friends, during those 5 years, I got used to taking care of my children. I made them breakfast in the morning, I read to them, I brushed their teeth at night, and fought off the toilet monster. I even enjoyed it. But after we graduated, I swung back towards righteousness for 2 years. Since both of our children were at school, it seemed all right for both my wife and I to work, especially since she taught at the school they attended. But during this time, strange thoughts began occurring to me. I started wondering if some misguided premortal soul was filling out the paperwork to come to our family. It was frightening because I knew that if we had a baby, one of us would have to stay home and take care of that baby, and that would cut our income in half. And I wasn't sure we'd be able to provide for our family that way. So I started going a little crazy. And in the car, I would blurt out things like, tell you what, If you give me a decent publishing contract for the novel about polygamous ghosts I'm writing right now, so I can work from home, you can send someone else to our family. I'm not really sure who I was talking to, but in the summer of 2008, I was hired as the editor of Sunstone, and almost immediately, my wife and I unwittingly initiated the reproductive process. Now, it's true that I didn't have a novel publishing contract, but it's also true that the Sunstone gig is likely much more lucrative, and by gum, I can work from home. So here I am, the stay-at-home dad. I play with my baby by day, while my wife works outside the home, and I edit Sunstone by night. What would President Benson think of this arrangement? Leaving the Sunstone question aside for a moment, I wonder if he might have any encouraging words for me and other stay-at-home dads. So I look through his famous speech to the mothers in Zion for some inspiration, and this passage jumped out at me. I switched the gendered nouns and pronouns so I can make it more applicable. No career approaches in importance that of husband, homemaker, father. Cooking meals, washing dishes. Why is this funny? Making beds for one's precious wife and children. Come home, husbands, to your wives. Make home a heaven for them. Come home, husbands, to your children, born and unborn. Wrap the fatherly cloak around you. And unembarrassed, help in a major role in creating the bodies for the immortal souls who anxiously await. I could really get behind that last part. Help in the major role of creating bodies. Though I'm not really sure what I'll need that fatherly cloak for. So can I be unembarrassed about being a stay-at-home dad? Might my particular abilities as a male help me to raise children well? What would I have to do to be successful? I have to admit that I didn't have much hope of finding much help on this, but lo and behold, in the same talk, President Benson outlines the things a person needs to do to raise children righteously. I'm going to list the entire list here for you. 1, be at the crossroads of your children's lives. 2, be a real friend. 3, read to your children. 4, pray with your children. 5, have weekly family home evenings. 6, be together at mealtimes. 7, read scriptures daily. 8, do things as a family. 9, teach your children. And 10, truly love your children. And that's it. That's everything that you have to do, according to President Benson, to raise righteous offspring. Did you notice something about that list? Not one of them requires anything female to carry it out. So a male is entirely capable of carrying out every one of those things, as long as you don't mind if I read Mad Magazine to my children. I have one more bit of hope to hold out to any man who finds himself in stay-at-home dad shoes. President Benson makes much of the once barren Hannah in the Bible, birthing the baby Samuel. She says, "For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore, also I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord." And President Benson says, isn't that beautiful? A mother praying to bear a child and then giving him to the Lord. But, as you may remember, Hannah gave the young Samuel to a man to raise. Admittedly, he hadn't done a really good job with his own sons, but he did all right with Samuel, who turned out to be one of the Old Testament's most vigorous and interesting prophets. Heck, Indiana Jones was raised by his dad. What more proof do you need?
Well, my name's Ken, and I'm Ken Gerber, and I'm grateful to be here today. I just want to make known that when I started out looking for a spouse, I did not look for someone who could keep me in the manner that I would like to become accustomed. I mean, that's not what my father had modeled. My dad was a police detective on LAPD for 18 years while I was growing up. My mother stayed home. She did a great job running the household. I think she hated every minute of it, but she did really well. I think she often wanted to go out into the working world. But one of the things that happened, I'm also the oldest of seven, and because of that, my dad would work 2 to 3 jobs. And I remember many times when my dad would come home after I went to sleep and leave before I got up. And often that was if he came home at all, because sometimes he would just go to the police academy and catch a couple hours sleep before his next job, rather than drive an hour and a half home. So because of being the oldest of seven and all but one of them being boys, things were not divided up in our house the way they are in many houses. We didn't have guys' chores and girls' chores, because that would have been really one-sided on our side. So I ended up changing many diapers before I ever got married and had my own kids. Cleaning the kitchen, the bathroom, and vacuuming was an expectation of me all my life. So because of this, the rules of men and women's jobs were kind of blurred. After my mission and 4 years in the Marine Corps, I decided to go to school. I had always dreamt of going into psychology. And I went down to Southern Utah University, which is a great place to go, especially if you want to have a few dates. But man seeking woman who will support him, their children, and buy him toys was not the ad that I ran. The fact that this was not my dream, nor was it the dream that I sold my wife, has come to bite me in the butt a time or two. And part of the reason is she was set up to be a stay-at-home mom. I mean, she's very talented. She can sew, she can cook, she can, you know, do all of the things, and raised by someone who raised her to be a stay-at-home mom. So that was her expectations, as well as my own. So the question is, how did I end up here? Or maybe more appropriately, how do others keep from ending up in my position? Well, it started innocently enough. In my case, I was running a retail ice cream outlet. Okay, I had an ice cream truck. The one with the 3 bars of music that goes through the neighborhoods. And I was working that, and one day our child care provider called up and said, I can't do it anymore. And so I was like, well, until I find somebody, I'll just take him to work with me. So I put him in the van with his car seat in the front seat, and when we were just tooling through the neighborhoods, he could play in the back, and I even had his potty chair way in the back, and we had it all set up, and he got all the free ice cream he could eat, so he thought it was the best situation ever. And he was one of my best salespeople, because guys, the kids would come up and he'd be pointing at the one, you know, the ice creams that he liked and stuff, and the ladies would be like, oh, he's so cute, can I buy your son an ice cream? One? Sure, you can pay full price for something and give it to my son. I've got no problem with it. So we went there, and we did that, goodness, for about 18 months. And he went with me, usually for up to 8 or 9 hours a day. And this was mostly the summertime. It was, less hours during the fall and spring, and none during the winter. But that's how I got my start in being a stay-at-home dad. And after doing that, because of my love of psychology and my desire to help people, we got into foster care. And in foster care, we had, and actually somehow the number got transcribed, I've had up to 16 kids come through my home Most of them teenagers, most of them between 14 and 18. And they lived with us anywhere from 6 months to a year. And they were all court-ordered into a drug and alcohol program. And because this was the thing that I enjoyed and the thing that, that was my baby, I was the one that was considered the primary caregiver. And I was the one who took these kids to their drug and alcohol meetings and you know, stayed at home and, you know, was there when they got back to school. And so we did that for a little over a year, and actually we did that for 2 or 3 years at different times. And then at another time I actually assisted a family who was, the dad had just become single, he had 5 kids and was working full time. So I stepped in, I would take my 2 boys over to his house, watch their kids all day, you know, clean his house and feed his kids and take care of them. And then my wife would come and we'd all have dinner together and then we'd go home. So I was taking care of 2 households. And, you know, my wife, she's really tried to be supportive of this, all of our relationship. And many times she has said that she will put her husband up against any housewife she's ever met. So I also would almost figured it out at one point. I almost got it right. I was working 12 to 14 hours a day. This time, instead of selling ice cream out of a truck, I was selling ice cream out of a truck. I was working for Schwann's. And so I was driving. I'd get there around 8 in the morning and wouldn't be home till around 11 at night. And my wife would bring my son was about three or four at the time. And my wife would often meet me at some park or something that was in the area that I was working, and we'd have dinner together for half hour, 45 minutes, and then I'd go back to work. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, we got back to that, if you get more education, you make more money. So we decided we'd go back to school. Some things had happened in our life that made that possible. And so we decided we'd move in with my in-laws in their basement. And my wife would go back to school. She was the one that was able to. I was going to go, you know, I was working 14 hours a day, so I hadn't applied yet, but she had applied and got accepted. So we came back to Utah, and in Utah, she started school, and I started working again. And I had been working a couple of months and ended up, instead of with ulcers, I ended up with seizures. And one day, I was sitting at my desk, and I woke up, and I was laying on my back and staring at the ceiling, and people were looking at me strangely. Hmm. And I had no idea what had gone on. So they rushed me to the hospital. They found out that I had seizures. They had no idea why or if I'd have any more. And so they sent me home, and we got just down from Orem down to Provo, and I had another seizure right there in the car. So my wife turned around and took me back to the hospital. I was still recovering from that, and just, you know, 2.5 months later, and my second son was born. And because I was still recovering and at home, I ended up being the stay-at-home dad, and I ended up taking care of my son. My wife would, you know, when my son cried at night, I would get up, get the baby, give him to my wife, she would feed him, I would take him, put him back to bed. And she kept going to school through all of this and working on her degree. And she finally got her degree. And it was kind of interesting because even as she's going, you know, and we were living in Spanish Fork at the time, and she was traveling to the U every day. And one of the things, she would talk to people on the bus and stuff. My wife is very outgoing. And she would tell people that she was going to school, and they were like, oh, so what are you studying? And she's like, well, chemistry and biology. And, oh, are you going to teach? Was always the next question, because they figured that anybody, any woman that was going to get a job was going to be a teacher. And she was like, no, that's not what I'm planning. At the time, she was actually planning on going to med school. That actually changed, and she's now a lab tech over at ARUP, and does a great job with that. As far as challenges, you know, there have been plenty. My wife and I have had to endure biases from coworkers, acquaintances, and even some of my wife's family. They have said things like, she should not be in the workforce but be at home with the kids, or I'm a slacker, or worse, for not being the breadwinner. And though my wife's employer works really hard at making things equitable, you know, just like every other place in the U.S., there's still evidence that there are problems of women being paid less than men for doing the same job. Like I said, we've lived in both Oregon and Utah, and we've had similar issues both places. But the hardest thing has seemed to be when we try to change places and go back and forth, because we have to learn a whole new job. You know, as far as my kids have handled things really well. The one situation that did come up when my youngest son was about 3, he started wearing his mom's shoes around. And it was really cute, and we asked him one day, you know, what's that about? Well, I want to be a mommy because I want to go to work. I don't want to stay at home like daddy. So we explained to him that usually in a lot of families, daddies are the ones that go to work, and he quit cross-dressing.
Wow.
To end with, I just want to say, you know, I've over the years tried everything that I could think of to make things different. I've prayed, fasted, gone to the temple, got some priesthood blessings, applied for jobs, started several businesses, and spoken with a handful of bishops, hoping for a different life experience. The experience did not change, so I decided I would. Anymore, I just kind of ignore the facts that what I'm doing is out of the norm and not accepted. If this is a sin, well, party on.
Okay.
I'll go to hell knowing that I was the best father I could be, and I filled the needs of my family to the best of my ability. And if this is the biggest problem my boys have to complain about, they'll probably get enough easy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think I actually have a lot to say about my experiences as a stay-at-home dad in the church, and I don't think I realized how much I have to say about it until I was asked to be on this panel and start to think more about it. I love my experience and count it as one of the most important in my life. I could have been happy doing it, I think, for another 20 years. I started in the summer of 2005 when my second child, a daughter, Claire Eliza, was born, and then stopped in. I started graduate school in the fall of 2008. So I'm going to talk about my personal experience, and actually, interestingly, I just thought of this, but I actually don't have a lot of personal experiences as far as being a stay-at-home dad as much as I have personal experiences with my experience in the church, which wasn't always positive. In hindsight, what I think is interesting, and I guess kind of what I think I have to offer to the panel is some of these sort of challenges that my wife Jessica and I had. And we kind of thought of ourselves when we started this process as this kind of liberated young couple that could easily cast off the gender dispositions that society had imposed upon us and assigned to us. And that's kind of the first thing that I want to talk about, is that it was definitely a mistake going into the experience to think that that was the case. And I'll try to delineate two reasons why, social and personal, although obviously social and personal is intertwined, because over time the social becomes embodied in the personal, and that was kind of the source of our struggles. So first, talking about social kind of dilemmas and struggles that we went through as we tried to get used to these role changes, and I'm going to talk specifically about family and church. And almost all my family's like half the audience here. So the first thing I guess is subtle sort of social cues and awkward interactions with people. I wouldn't say that people disapprove generally when you kind of tell them, you know, you're having small talk and you're talking about what are you doing, and I'm a stay-at-home dad. It wasn't so much disapproval as much as kind of an awkward not knowing how to respond, which was itself an indicator of kind of the oddity or the maybe the inappropriateness of the choice. And then another experience I had, a specific experience, was I was an Elders Quorum instructor during the first 2 years in the ward we lived in of being a stay-at-home dad. And once there was a lesson on fatherhood, and I'd been getting at that time sort of deep into some academic literature on father involvement and child development. And this was the beginnings of my choice to become a sociologist, was my experience as a stay-at-home dad. But in this lesson, I decided to share some of my experiences practicing what's labeled as nurturing fatherhood. And I shared kind of some basic findings and statistics about the importance of nurturing fatherhood in particular kind of developmental outcomes. And the lesson was pretty well received, and I was pleased with how it went. But then at the conclusion of the meeting, the member of the Elders Quorum who'd been conducting got up and he thanked me for the lesson, and then he's like, but we all know that, and by the way, if whenever someone starts a sentence in Elders Quorum, we all know, then predict will happen is maybe a not so subtle rebuking in the form of banal platitudes that, you know, we're kind of expected to take for granted, and hence the preface. We all know. So we all know that the proper role of the father is that of provider and protector, and that while it's okay to temporarily rearrange roles in a family if the husband can't find work, which was kind of itself an implication about me, then there's a model we've been taught to follow. We all know what that is, and we're blessed when we follow that model. And at the time, I was sensitive. I was very sensitive. I was, like, much more sensitive than I am now about it, and I had to even have some nerves to talk about it in the lesson. And so that was actually a pretty... That's kind of stuck with me. I mean, that was a pretty hurtful experience. I mean, as well intentioned. You know, it's nothing personal. I don't even remember anything about the person, actually. It's nothing personal. It was just kind of a thing that was difficult. And I also had a well-intentioned aunt one time give me kind of a lecture in her driveway after picking my kids up about how much they needed their mother and at home. And one time in my mom's, who's here, and she's totally supportive of me, and it was of the choice, but in the Christmas card, this is just a subtle thing, but in the Christmas card that was sent out, the news that was framed about me, it was basically framed in terms of a temporary decision that we were making, which... I mean, that was probably partly how I framed it, but it was just basically like the way to present this as an acceptable thing to all of my friends that I'm sending this to is that it's sort of a temporary thing, you know, because that's when it's socially acceptable. And so, but like I said, that was probably rooted in the fact that that's how I described it at first because of my own sort of sense of embarrassment a little bit in the beginnings. And so those were kind of some of the social pressures that we faced. And now to talk about a couple of the personal things. So some feminist and gender scholars understand gender to be a function of performance. So the argument is basically that femininity and masculinity is not necessarily something we are, essentially, so much as something that we do. Gender is something that's performed. And while I think this perspective is important in the way it orients analysis, social scientific analysis, towards practice, I think it can sometimes be mistaken about the depth with which gender informs the experience of identity. And this is exactly what happened to Jess and I. No matter how much satisfaction I thought I was supposed to get, formally we changed roles. So we were performing the role of the other. But it was just difficult because, for example, if I didn't fulfill the responsibility to keep the house clean, Jess was the one that felt the sort of shame about that, just because that was instilled as a value for her. So she felt it reflected more on her, even if it was, even though the performance of it was my responsibility. And you know, so it's just a deep, these are deep-seated values that we have, and also my own, you know, feelings about not being a provider of financial means for the family. You know, these are sort of deep-seated values that we have, but over time, you just keep going. I just kept going, and over time, I gained confidence and realized that as long as I tried to do things exactly as Jess would do them, or even sometimes as she wanted me to do them, I'd never really be successful or happy. So I started to develop my own routines, my own goals for the house, and it's interesting now comparatively, because she's been a stay-at-home mom for the last 2 years, to think about our different strengths and weaknesses. I think that the house generally is cleaner with Jess now, but the kitchen specifically was stayed cleaner with me, because that was just something that I needed to have a clean kitchen. And I think that in some ways the kids were on a more regimented schedule in terms of eating healthy, but it was more like the same thing every day. And so I think with Jess, they're learning a greater appreciation for a wide variety of food. And Jess reads.
Wow.
This is too strong.
I can try to
switch. Wow. That came on fast.
The recording. Yeah, well.
Try it again.
Okay.
You sound louder.
What?
Speaker volume? Yeah, turn it off once more, because it sounds like it's about to go.
Oh, I know what happened.
Oh, was it foot. Me?
You kicked it.
Okay, try again. Okay.
Okay. Try to keep my feet away from
okay.
It.
Okay,
talk some more.
Okay, are we there?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's better. Keep going.
Okay. Testing, testing.
Okay. Continue with your speech.
Okay. Okay, so yeah. I mean, there's differences in how we did it. And I guess the point of all that is that I kind of had to make the work my own and accept what I could do and could not do well in that capacity. And maybe even more important, in some ways more important, Jess had to come to accept, you know, her role, and also to accept my role, you know. And it was kind of difficult for her not to try to manage, you know, how I should do things. And again, because of these sort of deeply instilled dispositions. But once I started to make the work my own, I loved it, and I really enjoyed it. I'd say especially the last year of it, it was really fun, and I got into a routine. I felt confident in what I was doing, and I think as a result of the experience, my experience kind of ruined for me what some have called the pedestal argument for justifying gender differences within the church. So basically, mothers are often put upon a pedestal rhetorically for the supposed difficulty and thanklessness of the domestic work they do. And I'm not trying to say that it's not difficult or that it's not thankless, but just that I was very fulfilled and satisfied. I mean, in a lot of ways, much more than I am now as a graduate student, and constantly dissatisfied and feeling a constant sense of dissatisfaction. I mean, there's just nothing more satisfying than a successful episode of nurturing parenting, helping a frustrated child feel validated and witnessing them learning to work through their emotions, or teaching them a story or principle and hearing them later apply the story in a way that illustrates how they understand it, or even something as simple as feeding your children or giving them a bath and getting them into their pajamas, knowing that they're clean. These are all just immensely gratifying experiences. They were for me, at least. And I wish I could have continued in that role. I would have. I told Jess that I would have. The only thing I said is that if I wasn't going to, then it was going to be back to school for me. And that's kind of where we're at. Jess wanted to do it while our kids were still young. And so she's been a stay-at-home mom, like I said, the last couple of years. So how am I doing?
You got about 2 minutes.
Okay. So, yeah, just some concluding thoughts. These are some kind of concluding thoughts of the from my experience in sociology. And so, you know, this is probably the part of the talk that you can take less seriously. But basically, my thoughts are really informed by a French sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu, whose perspective just resonates with my own more than any other theorist. And basically, the point I want to make is that there's an order to the material world. And all I mean by that is that there's a statistical regularity in the ways that material resources are stratified. And all that means is that there exists inequality in the world, basically. And for Bourdieu, what he calls the justification maintenance of this inequality, he calls it sociodicy, which is obviously a play on the word theodicy, which means justifying faith in God despite the presence of evil in the world. And so the project for Bourdieu, the project of sociology, is to describe how culture is used to justify inequality, or in other words, as a sociodicy, how culture is used as sociodicy. And how he does this is to identify a symbolic order that overlays the material order, which naturalizes and dehistoricizes the categories we're placed in, such as race and gender. And roles of subordination can be taken on reflexively and in the spirit of pure love for others to which one is subordinating. More often, however, sociodicy is perpetuated by what Bourdieu refers to as symbolic violence, which he calls it a gentle violence, imperceptible and invisible, even to its victims, exerted for the most part through purely symbolic channels of communication, cognition, recognition, and more precisely, misrecognition of feeling. And an example of that would be parts of the Proclamation on the Family, which claimed that gender is an essential characteristic of identity and purpose, would be identified as by Bourdieu as symbolic violence, in that it perpetuates this sociodicy, or this justification of inequality in the material world. And so what does this have to do with stay-at-home fathering? Last thought. What I'd like to suggest is that there is a symbolic order that is crucial for the reproduction of patriarchal power structures, and that being a stay-at-home dad, much like being a same-sex couple, represents, or at least can represent, a movement of revolt against that symbolic order. And Bourdieu also talked a lot about the suffering of the oppressor, meaning suffering of what it means to be masculine. And that's just kind of the experience that I had as a stay-at-home dad. It really opened my eyes to this, and when I later read this, it just clicked for me. Power to the people, power to the stay-at-home dads, and revolution against the symbolic order.
Well, I guess that's a good segue to me, because I'm the only person on this panel who's a gay at home dad. A gad. When I was in the process of coming out and coming to terms with being gay, I actually went through a sort of mourning process, or a grieving process, because growing up I had always looked forward to being a father, and it was always one of the things that I thought I would be really good at, and when I came to the realization that I was gay, and that a relationship with a woman in a context where I could create my own children wasn't really going to work, I had to kind of rethink things. And
So I kind of got to this point where I was like, well, you know, not everybody in the world has to reproduce. And I can put my time and energy into other important things that society needs people to do, and I can be a good uncle to my brothers and sisters who have their own kids. And so I had kind of really written that out of my life. A few years ago, I actually had a spiritual experience here at Sunstone that brought me back to the LDS Church. I started attending church regularly and remained committed to my husband, my partner. And I was attending church with my parents on a visit here to Utah, and was at church with them, and I had a spiritual experience there in church, and I felt the Spirit telling me in a very clear and discernible way that I needed to open myself up to the possibility of parenting. And I had no idea how that was going to work. About 6 months later, a friend of mine who's a Mormon, and I had been introduced to her by another friend who said, you need to meet this person because she's a Mormon. And so we became friends, and she was a social worker, and she works with a foster care agency. And she one day called me on the phone and said, you know, I think that you and your partner would make really good parents. And have you ever thought of foster parenting? And I said to her, well, as a matter of fact, and I didn't mention the fact that I'd had a spiritual experience about this, but the moment she asked me that question, I said, okay, I need to be open to this. So I talked to my husband about it, and we went through a discernment process, and we eventually we talked to a lot of other foster parents, and we were concerned about the financial issues and the time issues, and one of the issues was, you know, if we're going to become foster parents, it's really important for us to have somebody who can be at home to, you know, care for our foster kids. And we were just kind of trying to figure out how that would work out. But eventually we, at the end of this discernment process, we throughout the months as we were discussing it and thinking about it, I'd look at him and I'd say, well, what do you think? You know, should we become foster parents or not? And he'd say, well, I'm 90% sure. And, you know, eventually, and then a week later he'd ask me and I'd say, well, I think I'm 95% sure. And finally we got to this point where we were both 100% sure. So we received our first placement almost 3 years ago. this was a kid whose father had died when he was 13 years old, and due to some chaos in the home that ensued after the death of his father and some details that I won't really get into, he ended up being taken out of his home and placed in foster care, and we were asked to basically become his parents until such time as he was able to transition to independent living. And he's with us now, and we're kind of on the edge of that now. We're about to see him start college at the University of Minnesota, and there's still some question about how long he's going to formally be our foster kid, but then we're going to open our home to other kids once he's ready to move on. So I had to kind of broker a deal with my law firm. I initially went to them and I said, I want to become a foster parent. And so we manage all of our cases at this law firm online. And so we have attorneys who, even though it's a Minneapolis-based firm, we have attorneys in California, we have attorneys in Ohio, Florida, Washington, and so on. And so there's no requirement that you actually be in the office to do the work. But I'm not a lawyer, I'm a paralegal. I said, hey, is there any way that I could work at home? And they said, well, you know, the attorneys really like to have somebody there to actually hand the papers to them so that they can sign them. So they didn't want to let me do it at first, but then sometime later the law firm switched to a paperless system so that we were no longer hand-delivering papers. We were generating electronic documents and emailing them to the attorneys, and the attorneys were affixing electronic signatures, and then we were affixing our own electronic signatures, and then we were beaming it to the patent office in Washington, D.C., and from the moment we switched to that paperless system, literally the day after we made the switch, I was literally just sitting all by myself in my office all day. I never saw another human being at work, you know, during the 7.5-8 hours that I was there. So I went back to them and I said, can I now finally please go home? And they sort of didn't want to let me do that, and so still, they said, if we let you do it, we'll have to let everybody do it. So finally, I was able to convince them by offering to be available to do late, sort of after-hours kind of services for the firm. And so we were finally able to broker that deal. And so I've been working at home and being an at-home dad since then, since September of 2009. The ghost of Spencer Kimball is around our house occasionally too, and you know, I'm active in my ward at in Minneapolis, and that's been a journey in itself. What's interesting to me from the point of view of this panel is I've actually kind of been surprised by the degree of acceptance of members of our ward, of me and my family. The first time I told my bishop that my husband and I were foster parents, he had this look in his eye that was kind of crazy. And I thought he was going to say something, but he didn't. He just kept whatever he was thinking to himself. And I'm formally excommunicated and not going to be allowed to be a member of the church so long as I'm in a committed relationship with my partner. So I don't know if that kind of just freed him of the responsibility of having to scold me for being gay and having a kid. That's the closest that I've come to having any sort of really negative reaction. I remember feeling really touched the first Father's Day after we had received our foster kid. And in our ward, they hand out little packets of chocolate to the dads. The moms get flowers and the dads get chocolate. And I was very touched when this young girl in the ward came up to me and gave me my little package of chocolate. We attended a ward picnic as a family, actually the Saturday before we came out here, and I'd say in general people have been pretty respectful. I think one of the big challenges in terms of my relationship with my husband and how we manage all of this, he's actually jealous. You know, he wants to be the stay-at-home dad, and that's what he had always envisioned. You know, he'd always envisioned that he was going to be the one staying at home with the kid, and I was going to be the one out in the cold, hard world, you know, putting bread on the table. And you know, it just happened. It just worked out this way. I was the one who was able to swing things at work to allow me to do this and to support us financially and also be present at home. You know, there is a kind of a price that I've had to pay at work. This was a high priority for me, and to me it was worth it to be at home and to be with our son. And I love that, and I feel like my life has been enriched by being able to be there for him at all times. And you know, he's a teenager, and he's been going through some pretty painful struggles as a teenager. And to be able to be there, you know, when he comes home from work or home from school, and he's crying or he's upset, and he needs somebody to talk to, and to be the person who can be there and do that for him, I wouldn't trade it for the world. But, you know, there's this kind of attitude at the firm that if you're not there in the office, somehow you're not as serious an employee. Or there have been attorneys who pulled work away from me because they wanted to have me, you know, sort of metaphorically there to hand them the papers or whatever. You know, so there is some of that kind of stuff. But generally, you know, to me, the stay-at-home part of being a stay-at-home dad feels right. It feels normal. You know, this is the highest priority in my life right now, is our son and the other kids that we plan to care for. So it feels right to me to arrange my life in a way that can be the highest priority. So.
Okay. This is an offering to compensate for my lack of skill in writing. I think it's papaya sorbetto. It's dairy-free and fat-free, so all of you can eat it. You don't have any excuse for not eating it. Take a spoon out. Take a nice big spoonful. Pass it around. And then if it gets all the way around and there's still some, send it back again and get another spoonful out. And my wife made this. This is gelato. We have it at our store in Sugar House. So if you don't get enough of it this evening, you can get more of it over there. My first response to this topic when they called me up and said, do you want to speak about stay-at-home dads? My first response was, don't. Now I'm going to hopefully articulate why. How did I get here? You got a degree in English. I got a degree in art, which is even less useful than English. I've been thinking about the debate over feminism, gender issues, etc., and how this relates to the topic at hand my whole life. Ultimately, to me, the issue is respect. How do we as individuals get and receive respect and value? Because ultimately, you know, we've been all implying that we have no value because we're stay-at-home dads. How do we value and treat each other? That is what we want. We want to be valued for what we do and who we are. And we want to value others. How do we as individuals, a community, culture, and religion do that? When I was around 14, I had my first encounter with budding feminism. I have five sisters and no brother. We were having a family meeting about domestic duties around the house. Some people argued that Dad didn't do enough housework. I remember thinking and arguing that that was unfair to expect him to work all day at school, which none of us helped him with, but he had to do more work when he got home. The fairness principle did not extend to shoveling snow, taking the garbage out, burning it in the winter, chopping wood, and a lot of other gender-related jobs that I had to do. But at least we were talking about and questioning some cultural expectations about gender. I never dreamed I would be a stay-at-home dad, though. When I got married, my first wife made it perfectly clear that she needed to earn a living. She never did explain how this would happen while also raising kids. During our first 3 years of marriage, we both worked part-time and had the first two of four children. Then she got a full-time job, which meant I would stay at home with the kids. Other than money I brought into the marriage, I built two homes and four cabins during each summer when she was not working and painted. This was the only time I felt any sense of accomplishment and value. I failed to appreciate, during this time I was a stay-at-home dad though, I failed to appreciate the blessings of raising kids. I just had the best opportunity of my life. And I failed to optimize what an incredible opportunity that was, to enjoy my children's youth as much as I could, not to mention a lot of failures in my marriage. I genuinely ache for those lost moments with my children and mourn over the times that I became impatient or angry with them over things that did not matter. What a stupid, selfish idiot I was. On top of that, I spent a lot of time apologizing for being male and bending over backwards to be the so-called liberal, liberated, sensitive male in order to not upset my so-called feminist wife. Frankly, I think I was just lazy or too weak to take a stand for something powerful and was looking for an excuse. I don't know if I explained that clearly. I did everything I could to be just really nice and accommodating, thinking I was being generous and thinking I was being a superior male or something better. And I think it was just a cover for not taking a stand for anything. While apologizing for the heritage of a patriarchal society is a step forward, failing to take a stand for something else is two steps back. Also, I was dealing with a wife who had her own struggles with gender identity and roles. While she loved her children and cared for them very well, she resented the role of motherhood that her culture and religion and society expected of her, defied any validation that they offered, and craved and pursued a professional life and validation at the same time, but that was only made possible by an inheritance and the fact that I was a stay-at-home dad. She resented me staying with the kids, the help that we received, and not being able to have it all, to be a professional writer, teacher, and mother. I resented my own isolation and lack of validation in the community or time to pursue my interests as an artist and grew lazy and insecure. This continued for 12 years. 9 years ago, when my wife had finished her PhD work and my youngest was about to start first grade, my wife left me for someone else. Frankly, I don't blame her. Before I even finished going through severe depression, she had custody, control, money, her job, employability, security, and a new partner. Everything a traditional male should usually have in a divorce situation. Now, I tell this melodrama as a cautionary tale of gender role reversal. When people marry, they enter a bond of trust. Each person provides different things to the marriage: money, emotional security, sex, companionship, etc. This makes both partners vulnerable, which is part of the risk and reward of marriage. Our culture erects all sorts of social constructs that supports that institution when it succeeds, and to a lesser extent when it fails. Until recently, women have been extremely vulnerable both in and out of marriage. Each year they are out of the workforce, raising children, they become economically marginalized. Child support and alimony are an attempt to address this injustice. There are also many cultural and social support for women in this situation. Our current laws and cultural institutions do not support men raising children. Until our laws and society changes, male homemakers are more vulnerable than women in a similar situation. But even if that changes, there is something more fundamental here. Everyone needs to belong and feel useful. Men need to provide, to do something, to fix something. Now, it is an established fact that men and women communicate differently. And when women communicate a problem, what do men want to do?
Fix it.
Women usually just want to be heard. Men want to fix the problem. Whether this is a social construct or our nature, I don't know. But I do know that I was trying to live in a situation I didn't fully understand and did not have any support system to understand. I became less powerful and capable as a person. Not because I was a stay-at-home dad. It just made it much more difficult to create ways of self-validation. It is hard enough for women to feel a sense of self-worth and accomplishment at the end of a day of changing diapers and talking with children. But there is at least a cultural expectation and support system for that. Men do not have that. They are alone and highly suspect in that situation. My in-laws thought I was lazy, no one respected me, and neither did I. My children did not and still don't respect me as a provider. And you notice how all of us have been kind of rather facetiously mock our sense of worth as fathers and what we're doing, and that none of us chose this. And, you know, it's like we still feel kind of guilty about what we're doing. Should this change? Yes. How? I don't know. I do subscribe to the principles our leaders tell us, that men should be providers. I don't agree with the cultural manifestation of that. I'm not sure how to describe that. The principle is that children need to be cared for and loved by their parents and raised by parents. Should it only be the mother? No. But I don't agree with the way our culture manifests or practices that principle, which I believe in. If a man cannot fix something or provide for, he is lost. What am I doing now? I'm now married to someone who loves and wants to be a mother and grandmother and finds great validation in that, who expects and counts on me to be a righteous priesthood holder, to be a provider, a leader. She tells me this, and I am honored to do that, to work towards that. And when I do that, I do not feel superior or better than her in any way. But I do feel more powerful as a person, and I have far more respect for myself. Ironically, the two of us now are working harder together every day in and out of our house than we ever did in our previous marriage. And we are working harder than our spouses ever did in our previous marriages. So this isn't about work or being at home. And ironically, it's because both of us were in the situation of being the, I don't know, inferior person in our previous marriages, the homemaker, which made us more vulnerable economically. And I'm not even sure what the conclusion is that I have, other than, and I don't want this to sound like, you know, this is a misery trip or, you know, don't ever do this. Everyone's experience is different. But my gut feeling is if you are not sensitive to some predominant, and I say predominant, male needs, because obviously every man is different, you must proceed with caution and awareness of what kind of dynamic you are creating. And that you are making yourself vulnerable in ways that our culture and our legal system do not support. And you need to be a very strong person in order to deal with that and have a very strong character to deal with that. Thanks.
Well, I'd say this panel has quite rocked. That was even better than I thought it would be. So we've got about 15 minutes for questions and answers. And you can direct it to anybody on
there's
the panel.
There's still gelato.
Yeah, there's
I
still
hate to see
gelato,
gelato melting, so keep passing that around.
John actually hasn't had any. But if you would come up to that microphone and address your questions, and we will address you back.
Hey guys, I had a comment first. Is this on? I can't hear it here.
Yeah, turn it on. I think I turned it off when I was just
okay. Awesome. So everybody can hear. First, a comment. I hear a lot of you guys saying that these echoes of voices saying you need to be providers, and what I also hear is that you are all providing something that money can't buy. You can't go to work and buy happiness for your children. And that was just a comment I wanted to say. And also, I wanted to thank John for showing us emotion and showing how much he cares about his son. That's really amazing. What I wanted to see if you guys could share was maybe the difference between working a job type job and then being a father, and the emotional difference you share with your children.
Actually, Miriam, his sister-in-law, my sister-in-law.
Closer.
His sister-in-law and my sister-in-law, Miriam, I was discussing this panel with her a few days ago. And she said, it doesn't sound like a stay-at-home dad panel. It sounds like a work-from-home dad panel. And I thought, you know, that's really interesting because it's very hard for me to conceive of being at home and working and not working. That's like inconceivable to me somehow. And it is terribly important that I feel like I'm putting something toward the maintenance of our family. I forgot what your question was.
Emotional connection with your children.
Oh, yeah.
When you're at work as opposed to when you're a stay-at-home dad.
Yeah, when our baby came, I have to work from 8 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning and then get up at about 7 with her to take care of her, so I don't get much sleep. And sometimes I think about this, but then I realize that I've never smiled so much in my life as I have this past year and a half. And I don't smile the entire time that I'm editing Sunstone. I have a good time. But it's not a smile fest.
I think it's interesting you brought up that point that we're all work-at-home dads. I'm curious to know how any of you would respond to the notion of just being a stay-at-home dad and not working, not having any other profession, but just caring for kids. Could you do that?
Sure.
And if you could, I think it supports my position that men have to provide something. They have to do something else. They have to make something. I don't know. I'd like your response to that.
Well, that's an interesting question. My partner tells me that he would love nothing more than for me to go out and work and him to stay at home and do nothing but take care of kids and take care of the home. I haven't really thought about that, though. It is hard for me to imagine not writing or being involved in some kind of creative endeavor in addition to the work that I do. But I was going to say in response to the question that I don't notice any real qualitative difference in terms of how I relate to our son when I've still had to be, you know, working and then, you know, coming home and being a parent after coming home from work. It's more of a quantitative difference. It's just that there's more presence. I can be there more of the time. I can respond immediately to, you know, particular needs and just kind of be a presence in his life in a way that I couldn't if I was out of the home.
Actually, coming here this morning, I had a conversation with Jess and was telling her some things I was going to say, and she was kind of correcting some of the history that I was going to give. And so I think that, could I ever do it full-time? I mean, all the way, no, and not doing any work. I think that it was a transition, so we didn't have that much time. And, for example, I just always hated... There was one thing I always hated, which was cleaning the kids' toys, the kids' room. And so Jess always did that, and then
Jess always did what?
Cleaned the kids' room. I mean, there were just little things that we, but it was kind of a process. So I think that over time, I could have kind of built up enough self-confidence to really fully take that on. And I actually did approach it as a job. I mean, that's when I started to really like it, is that I'm just a person who likes to have systems and methods for doing everything. And so once I did that and was like, you know, these are the things that I have to do and treated it more like a job, actually, that's when I started enjoying it more. And so, I don't know.
And I don't think that I could ever just do that. I am one that wants to have something else to do also. And especially now, both of my boys are in school. My oldest is 16 and my youngest is 10. So, you know, I have a few hours during the day where I would go stir crazy if there wasn't, you know, something to do and somebody to call.
This session gave me a lot of hope, and I don't know if you can be proud of strangers, but I'm really proud of you for what you've done, and it makes me feel like little things are changing in the world for the better. So I really appreciate all of you for speaking, and I love the word, say it again, sociodicy.
Yeah.
That's just the best. So, but I just wanted to share a couple things. I read somewhere, and I can't remember where now, and it doesn't matter if it's true or not because it affected me and changed some behaviors, but I read somewhere that the average American kid talks to his or her parent or his or her father for 3 minutes a day on average. Hmm. And I was like, no, that can't be. That's crazy. And then I started timing how much I talked to my dad, and it was about that. And I consider my dad and I to be close. And it was really shocking to me. And then I timed how much I talked to my mom, and it was a lot. And I realized, like, that's tragic that I would be denied a relationship with my dad because of sociodicy or whatever, you know, these things that we say are necessary. And so we started having some family conversations. And we got into some really cool conversations, and my dad finally admitted that he hates his job, and he only did it because he felt like he was supposed to, and he really wants to be a woodworker. And my mom admitted that she wants to write a book. And, you know, and I said to my dad finally, I was like, you didn't, I appreciate the work you did, but you didn't do us a favor by doing something that you hated, you know? Like, we just would have rather had you here. And so, some things might be changing in my family, they might not be, but we've had some good talks. So I just think this is part of that conversation, and I just really appreciate what you all are doing, and it makes it, I guess, addressing the question of producing something or not producing, I like the word create better, and I think that men staying at home with their kids can level the playing field enough so that we can actually have a conversation that is more fair. It's not like being with kids, it's not productive, and it's not ennobling, and working is, or vice versa. It's that people want to create things, and they want to create art, or they want to write. So I don't think it's really an issue of could you create children's, you know, lives and make their world safe and happy versus could you create some art or create whatever. I just think it's, do you want to create, and do you want to live in a world where everybody is equally entitled to create? And that it brings the conversation back to, like, creating a world for a child is one of the most profound things you could possibly do. And I would hope to live in a world where moms and dads can both do that. So I appreciate what you guys said.
So I'm kind of struck listening to this, how it sounds like there's, you know, most men and most women seem to be saying a similar thing, which is there's something very powerfully validating about a regular job. And so I think there's something very interesting there, you know, and it may be that the solution for, you know, having people be able to raise families and spend plenty of time with their kids is something about people being able in that period of their life to have a job that's part-time but still fully validating. But there's something about the construction, there's something wonderful and amazing about the construction of jobs in our society that really validates people. If we could figure out the secret of that, maybe we could validate ourselves and validate each other in the same way. But it's something that's, what I'm hearing is that that's uniquely powerful, is that the way that regular jobs are in kind of validating people. What do you think about that?
You know, in my first marriage, I had all the money I needed and security and a beautiful home, and I was financially set, but I was a miserable person. Right now, I am an economic failure, but I find far more joy now in my relationship and when I have those tiny little moments with my kids than I ever did before. Now, I had to go through a hellish process to get to that point. But our culture, our capitalistic culture, teaches us over and over and over, the only real validation is money and power and jobs and position in society. And women are told over and over and over, you're not valuable unless you go out and make money. And that you should feel embarrassed because you're only a homemaker. And men are given the same stupid, evil, consumerist message. And both men and women suffer because of that. And children suffer because of that. And we're fighting against, you know, a culture that, one, demand. I mean, I look at my brothers-in-law. They put in 60, 70 hours a week in these hellish jobs that take them away from their family and kills them. And, you know, their wives don't see them, their kids don't see them, and that's what our capitalist culture demands of them. And you know, you had so much difficulty trying to get your boss to accommodate something that ultimately would be better for them as well. They want your lives. I mean, it's the Mahan principle, your money for your life. And it's anti-family, and it's anti-principle, which is children need to be cared for, whether it's the mother or the father. Well, it's the mother and the father, and they both need to be there. And obviously, they can't both be there equally. But our culture and our capitalist society demands that.
I kind of don't hear a lot of work being done in our society trying to deconstruct that. I mean, it's a little bit like I mean, listening to this...
That's going against a $100 trillion industry.
And I'm listening to this panel, it's a little bit as if, in terms of the psychological feelings people that you all reported, it's a little bit like the bulldozer ran over everyone. And somehow this bulldozer's, there's not much that... There's not much stopping it.
Well, see, it feels to me like, I guess my satisfaction level just went through the roof when I was able to shift the priorities. And so, you know, I think Mark is right. I mean, the world... constructs things with a different set of priorities, and so if anything, it really reaffirms, you know, what church leaders say when they say that no success outside of the home can compensate for failure in the home. So I'm fine with my law firm job. I mean, it's okay, but it has to have the right place in my life. You know, it can't take over, it can't be more important than... And so, you know, I feel really good about having been able to maybe shift things a little bit so that I can focus more on family, which is really the really important thing. And it's really hard for my partner. He mourns not being able to be at home and share in some of the things that I'm able to share in. And so one of the struggles we're really trying to figure out right now is how can we do this so that he can have more involvement at home. And he works for a law firm too, and they are far less flexible than even the one that I work for. So it's like pulling teeth to try to get, you know, the business world to... you know, allow us to structure things in a more humane, family-centered way.
Going back just to Ashley's comment about change in the church, I want to... in my presentation, maybe came across as negative, and I think that in relation, you know, as far as the relationship with the church, my personal relationship with the church goes, being a stay-at-home dad wasn't a positive experience, and there were a lot of ways that I felt that... the church, which promised to strengthen my family, actually damaged my family. But that being said, I want to kind of backtrack a little bit and in response to that comment and say that I do think that the way the church teaches fatherhood and emphasis, and they don't use the word nurturing fatherhood, but that's basically what they teach. It's in the lesson manuals, and you can discern it in the talks, that the kind of parenting advocated for fathers in their relationship to their children is what I would call nurturing fatherhood. And I think that actually, above almost more than any other social force, has the potential for sort of like revolutionary change because of what it produces in kids. It produces in kids a relationship with authority where they're trusting, and, you know, it's basically the opposite of an authoritarian model of parenting. And I just think that that's a very powerful thing that I want to give credit where credit is due for the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the end of our time. Thank you so much. I had a great time.